Okay, we might as well begin here. This is Professor Bordway with MBA Educational Horizons, and today's session will be focusing on the California Supplemental Exam, and we do just a little kind of a summarization in this particular session. Normally, we have a two-hour in-person free seminars that we offer for the California Supplemental Exam as well as the Architectural Registration Exam. But for those that can't make that, that's why we kind of make this available to them, just a summarization of that particular session or seminar. And so we'll be going through and taking a look at all the things that the candidate has tested on in this session, along with some suggested techniques on how to take this exam. And, of course, if you have any questions, you can always give me a call. This is what I do pretty much full-time. The number here is 949-area-code-208-2979. That's 949-area-code-208-2979. And then just leave a message if I'm on the other line, and I'll get back with you. My goal here is to get you through these exams as quickly as possible and move on with life. So let's talk a little bit about the history of the California oral exam. It's right now, at this time, it is a formal presentation that one needs to go up in front of a panel of three test graders, and you'll be asked a series of questions, right around 35-some-odd questions. And it's a matter of answering them appropriately so we can get the credit and pass this exam. The exam should not last an hour, more than an hour, hour and a half at the most, I would say. You need to be in and out. The less they know about you, the better. The less words you use in this exam, the better. The more summarized and compressed your answer can be. That's kind of the goal, I think, that we're shooting for. That's what's on their answer list. This exam, by the way, has nothing to do with the candidate's personal experience. So my recommendation is to leave your experience outside the door. When you walk into this exam, you need to be thinking theoretical, ideal, textbook type of answer. Okay. So it's a reflection of the knowledge that we need to have to get past this exam, not how much experience I have in this profession. Okay. So the types of questions that are asked in this exam, normally, there's three types. One is like a straightforward type of question right out of the textbook or the practice act. And then another type of question would be a situation set up scenario where they tell you a story and then ask you what should the architect or the owner or the construction manager do in this situation and such. If you ever hear the term sequential ordinal way of grading, that's kind of where that comes into play. What should you do first, second, third, fourth, and so on? And then the third type of question I've termed over the year, I call it backdoor tricky, where it's kind of an incorrect question or scenario that's presented to the candidate just to see how they would respond. Okay. And so there's like three types of questions in this exam. The questions are multi-parts, you know, six, seven, sometimes eight-part questions. So we need to, you know, not get overwhelmed with it, but just focus in on it. So you can, as I say, chunk it down, break it down into the different parts of answering, the question. You don't have to answer the whole question first shot. You know, you can break it down, chunk it down, and as long as you keep the panel with you when you respond. Then they know, what you're saying, and they give you proper credit for what you're saying and such. But if you talk too fast or you kind of mumble or, that type of thing, then you could be saying something correctly, but they're not giving you the credit because they, it went right by them. And normally they don't try to interrupt you in your response either. So you have to just kind of have a technique going into this exam. This exam is offered three times down in Southern California and three times in Northern California at this time. And, of course, when it goes into written format in January of 2011, then they'll probably end up just leaving it up to the candidate to take it when they can or whatever. But I don't know. I'm not sure about the rules on that yet. So the best thing to do is just call Sacramento if you're going up for that type of exam in January 2011. Past history, though, has been whenever there's a new exam, usually CAB, California Architecture Board, doesn't really release any information until about 3 or 4 weeks prior to that exam. So I'm thinking around the end of November we might hear something about the format of the new exam in January of 2011. I think the exam is going to be a little more complicated personally because there's going to be one screen. You only get one computer screen, so there are going to be drawings you have to look at, and then you have to go back and answer the questions. There's going to be a lot of back and forth stuff if they're not going to give you some type of a handout. Normally they don't on this type of, if they go over to ProMetric. So anyway, for this exam right now, 2010, you'll be presenting in front of a live panel of three. And the exam this year is offered three times in Southern California and three times up in Northern California. So let's see, the months January in 2010 was already offered in Southern California. March, it'll be offered in Burlingame, I think Northern California. And then in May, it'll be offered back here in Southern California. I think it's Anaheim. And then back up again in Burlingame or Northern California. That'll be July. And then back down here September. And then back up again in Northern California November. Okay, so and it's taking right around 6 to 9 months to get back in if you don't pass. So best thing to do, of course, is to be well prepared going into this thing and try to get it first shot and you're done with it type of thing instead of spending a lot of extra money and, you know, going back in again. So anyway, the types of questions, again, it's a matter of answering on a theoretical basis and do the best we can for this exam. The type of, the categories of questions, just looking at your list of 11 items in your test plan that you might have had printed out there, they don't send you any information anymore. I believe you got to print it out right off their California Architectural Board website. But the brochure, candidate brochure, of course, and the reading material, that's where they go through and talk about the four areas that you're tested on, we call them categories, and then the list of 11 items for reading material for this exam. So looking at the list of reading material, we have the California Supplemental Examination Candidate Brochure, and then, of course, the number two is the Practice Act, and you can download that. I think 2008 was the latest edition there, PDF format. And then item number three is the contractor's license law issues, lien laws. So we'll be looking at that information. And then the public contract code when an architect is involved with a public project. So we've got that. Item number five would be general plan issues. Six is Essential Service Buildings Seismic Safety Act. Seven is the California Design Professional Lien issues. Eight is the Coastal Act. Nine is the Handbook of Professional Practice. And I believe we're looking at the 14th edition 2007 contracts that were updated. You might want to be looking at. Number 10 is are all the parts of the Title 24. Now, in this exam, you're only tested on one title. In the state of California, we have a number of titles. You go to another state and say titles, they don't know what you're talking about. But California, we put all our codes under titles. And for this exam, we have 30-some-odd titles in this state. But for this exam, you're only tested on one title, which is Title 24. Okay. And under Title 24, there's a number of parts, as you can see from this reading list here, item number 10. Part 1 is the Building Standards Administrative Code. Part 2 is the volumes 1 and 2 that we look at as architects and engineers. Part 3 is electrical, 4 is mechanical, 5 is plumbing, 6 is energy issues, and 8 is historical building code. And then we end up with list number 11, which is CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act issues. Okay, so these are the items that the candidate is tested on for the exam. Okay. And it's a matter of being strong on those items, as well as, of course, the categories. The combination of knowing this information, coming across with a high level of conviction, okay, belief in what you're saying, of course, looking well, acting, speaking well, professional, all of that, usually gets the candidate through this thing, okay? But if you don't present yourself well, or the information you're presenting is in a doubtful way, they're going to find something wrong with you, normally has been the case in the past, just because of the way you're presenting yourself. So the theory goes, all right? But it's best just to go in and look and act professional, speak well, have all the correct information, okay, and then deliver it. And I suggest that you deliver it in a what I call the 1 minute type of time frame, okay? The rule, a 1 minute rule. All right. So when you're answering, either it's in parts of the question and such, try to do it in less than a minute if you can. I mean, the average human being speaks, what, 200, 250 words a minute. You can get, I think, all of these questions answered, all parts of each question answered in less than 250 words. So you have to choose your words carefully. In the candidate brochure, it says that we have to be very well versed on the B-102 and the B-201, which replace the old B-141 agreement between architect and owner. Also, to be versed on the A-201, general condition of the contract for construction. Okay. Of course, there's other segments of the AIA contracts that we have to be aware of as well. But those are the three main ones that you should have a good handle on before you go into this exam. Okay. Now let's just take a look at the reading material again a little deeper here. The Practice Act, written by the California Architectural Board, and again, 2008 is the latest edition. And it's a matter of taking a look at, you know, the specifics about the Practice Act. Okay. And what is the definition of an architect, for example? And, you know, we have to make sure that we understand that an architect is an individual who has received their license to practice architecture. Okay, you might be doing architecture for another firm, okay, and you're practicing under their license, so to speak, but you are not an architect until you have received your license to practice architecture in this state. Okay, when I first started my office, in Southern California, I was not licensed, and I had to go in and take all the word architect out of every contract and put designer in or intern or something like that to keep it legal. Okay, and then once I became licensed, I went back and changed it again. But so you have to watch out for not calling yourself an architect until you received your license in this state. You might be an architect in other states. Okay, but until you have received your license in this state, you're not defined as an architect. On Section 50500.1, Practicing of Architecture, and I'm just looking at the Practice Act, okay, as I go through this information, it talks here about seven items of what is meant by practicing architecture. So it's a matter of going through and taking a look at what is meant by practicing architecture. Also, you might want to understand responsible control defined, 5535.1. They are asking that question in the orals. And also partnerships with non-architects, which is also acceptable, but you have to fill out a form for that, 5535.2. Okay. Also, the five things that are noted in a written contract between owner and architect, and there it's listed 5536.22, as well as the four conditions when an architect could proceed on a project, category, subcategory B to that. So you might want to look closely at those particular areas there. Okay, four types of projects that an unlicensed individual can do, and you might want to take a look at that one, 5537. They used to be asking that question, so... 5582.1, of course, signing other plans or instruments. And here, if a client walks into your office, of course, you can't just go and and you know, they have a set of drawings generated by somebody else, and they ask you to stamp and sign them. Of course, that's illegal. I mean, what does stamp and signing mean? You know, it means that you generated those documents, or your force, which means employees in your office under your direct responsible control and supervision. It means you complied with all client and agency criteria. It means that when you stamp and sign documents, that you own the copyrights to those documents as well. You see, as an architect, I don't stamp and sign my consultants' documents. They do. They own the copyrights to those documents, and I own the copyrights to mine. Okay, so it's just a matter of understanding the significance of stamping and signing or sealing documents. So you have to take a look at that. License law issues, mechanic lien laws. Here we're talking about anyone that submits labor and or material to a project has the right to properly be compensated if they've done correct work and delivered correct materials. And if they haven't, then their recourse is to file a claim dead lien against the project if they have filed this, what is called 20-day preliminary notice. Now, a 20-day preliminary notice filed with the county recorder's office just identifies them as to who they are and their legal attachment to the project in the event that they're not paid. Okay. And keep in mind that all claims, debts, and liens must be removed from the project, the APN, or assessor's parcel number on that project, before a C of O can be issued, certificate of occupancy. So the client starts to get a little nervous here about when claims, debts, and liens are getting to be attached to the project, okay? So claims, debts, and liens, mechanic lien laws, preliminary notices are not derogatory. It's just procedural, okay? So it's a matter of taking a look at that one. Public contract code issues, when architects are working with public contracts using public money, when the client's using public money, then, of course, there's certain rules to follow there as far as advertising to all the contractors that are large in the area. If they're bondable, they qualify. The owner has to select the lowest bid, okay, for that particular project. Essential services is another area that the candidate's tested on. And essential service buildings are buildings that are designed with a higher level of integrity to prevent them from failing in the event of some type of disaster, earthquake or strong wind force, tornado, things of that sort, which we are getting in California now. So it's a matter of making sure these buildings are designed with a higher level of integrity. And integrity in a building comes down to two things, which is fire and seismic resistivity. So it's a matter of just looking at that extract that says that these elements must be designed insofar as practical to resist the forces generated by gravity, earthquake, winds, fire, regarding the structural elements as well as the non-structural elements. Of course, non-structural elements would be what? Communication systems, main transformers, switching equipment, emergency backup systems, to name a few, aside from the standard FFE, furnishing fixtures and equipment. Of course, these types of buildings would be what? Fire station, police station, emergency operations center, highway patrol office, sheriff's office, and the like, right? And on these particular projects, the architect does not have an option. They do have to provide construction administration. On any other type of project, then we do have the option as architects. On these types of projects, it requires continuous inspection from a state certified inspector as well, qualified inspector. And we submit these documents to state agencies for review and approval, permits, and, of course, inspections requirements come out of that office as well. So the local agency doesn't really have any jurisdiction on these types of projects, okay? So the local building and safety and city and county building and safety and such don't really have any jurisdiction on these types of projects. Design professional liens, they talk a little bit about that again, and that would be Chapter 8, 3081.1 to 3081.10, and you can so this is just talking about the conditions when an architect can file a lien. Most of the time, AIA would recommend the three-step process, which is mediation, arbitration, and litigation. Mediation, of course, is just hiring a professional mediator, and that's not really recognized by courts. I mean, attorneys can attend to represent the clients and such. But the purpose of the mediation is come as some common ground of agreement and then move on, you know. And the second process, if you're not happy there on that ruling, was to go to arbitration. You get one arbitrator certified by the American Arbitration Board, and you have to go to one of the big cities here in California. So Sacramento, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, one of them. And then you it's like a mini court system going on. Attorneys are allowed, expert witnessing, files, all of that, and depositions, interrogatories, and the like. And so we go through that process. And if both parties agree non-binding arbitration, then you can appeal it and go to litigation, which is judge, jury, court. So each level gets more expensive. The idea is to try to stay out of court altogether. So the next item is California Coastal Act, and here we have a number of concerns they have. The zone, of course, is from Oregon border, California-Oregon to California-Mexico. And then 3 miles out to sea, up to 5 miles inland. And so they call it the 1,100-mile stretch, okay, along the coast. And so if your project is within that zone, then we do have to communicate and coordinate with the California Coastal Commission, who enforces the Coastal Act, okay? So you have to take a look at that. And they can, you know, dictate architectural styles to you and how is it fitting into context, you know, and that type of thing as well. So just be aware of the Coastal Act. And then we have the Handbook of Professional Practice and the contracts that have changed in that particular era. Now, AIA updates their contracts every 10 years. So 07 was the latest addition. And not all contracts are updated, but some of them are. Sometimes the numbers change, you know, and that type of thing as the context. But, you know, again, you might want to look at the 2001 the A201 2007 edition, and again, this is the 14th edition of the Handbook of Professional Practice, and you'll get a book, and then you say, well, where are the contracts? Because the whole book is just how to run an office and so on, but in the back, there's a CD-ROM, and you put that into your computer, and that's where the contracts are. Okay, now you can print out some of them, some of you cannot, so you might have to call the local AIA office for maybe a code number to release you to print those out, those sample copies. There's also the B-141, which is updated, and now we call it the B-102, which is part one of the old B-141, that describes responsibilities of each party, owner and architect. Then the B-201 would be the specific phases that the owner hires the architect for. Okay, that's the second part of the old B-141. Okay. So you can kind of read through some of the contracts that were updated here, you know, we're looking for some questions there regarding the updated contracts. You might have questions regarding the older contracts as well. 97, I mean, some of the contracts that were updated in 97 didn't change in 07. Instruction to bidders, the A701 that we send out, didn't change. And so it's a matter of kind of just looking at an overall review, okay, contracts that did not change and contracts that did in 07, okay. The old B-163 went away in May of 2009, I believe it was, but that's still a nice little document to look at for the different phases of the project. So you can kind of read through some of these contracts. I'm just kind of flipping through our booklet here. And, you know, they got the bid, but different bonds, bid bond, and then the performance bond and payment bond. Okay, bid bond is in the event that the selected bidder falls out, the next highest bidder will be selected. That difference in bid is paid to the owner by the surety based on the policy, right, or the cap max. So you have a bid bond protection. That's the A310. And A312 is performance bond, payment bond. Performance bond portion is in the event that the selected contractor who starts the project cannot finish it. So the downtime translated in liquidated damages is paid to the owner again by the surety to get a new GC up and running and move forward. The purpose of performance bond is to complete or perform the project. And then we have payment bond in the event that someone is getting ready to file a claim debt lien on the project. For some reason, after proper investigation, surety should step in and then cut those individuals a check, the laborer or supplier, to prevent a claim debt lien from being filed on the project. See, when anybody does anything in law, they always have to notify the other party first. So these individuals have to file what is called notice of intent to file and send that to the GC, the owner, the surety, and give everyone the heads up that in 2 weeks, if their invoice isn't satisfied, then they will have to go down and file a claim debt lien. So notice of intent to file does get the owner's attention and everyone's attention that we got to take care of this, you know, type of thing. And then the surety after it has a certain time frame to do an investigation. And if they find that the those individuals do require payment, then they will send them off a check and then deduct that from the next payment to the GC, for example. And the B305 used to be the B431, I believe. They just changed numbers. This is the architect's qualification statement, so how we, an architect qualifies himself and such. So we have to take a look at that. And then, you know, based on experience and qualifications, you know, so capabilities. I believe the question in the orals is how does an architect reflect their capabilities and experience on this project? And it goes on to, in other parts as well. But keep in mind, capabilities are what are you capable of today, and experience is past action which created your capabilities. So, you know, you can answer kind of that way in that thinking. The D101 is the estimation form that we still need to submit, and it's part of the Big Five, what I call the Big Five. Whenever I hear the term construction documents, I think Big Five, which would be drawing, specifications, calculations, reports, and cost estimation. Okay, and the cost estimation here, we're calling it as the D101, and this is based on area, square footage, volume, cubic analysis, to make sure that that we are submitting to the client, to the best of our knowledge, the best estimation we can, estimation of probable construction costs, to stay within the constraints of the budget given to us by the owner, okay? And we do that progressively. I say 3 to 4 times in each phase you're hired for. I would really swing the other way and being very over-conservative in this exam, okay? So you want to submit the Big Five progressively. You know, 3 times in the DD phase and 3 times in the CD phase, you know, either 30, 60, 90% or whatever, you know, to try to get, keep the client involved, informed, get them to sign off to confirm that they had received it, levels of protection, right? And so, I mean, when you think about it, that's kind of what this exam is about. I mean, here come 30 or 35 questions on how architects have gotten in trouble before. Okay, and so how? What is the best way that we can answer these types of questions? All right, if you know where they're coming from in the question, you pretty much know where to go in your answer, which is one of the tricks in this exam. Okay, so anyway, you can take a look at the rest of the AIE contracts there and how they relate. You know, there's the A201, which is kind of important as well for this exam. And you know, if you look at you know, owner's right to carry out the work, you know, if the general contractor is not doing conforming work, in other words, according to the documents. So you can take a look at that Article 2.4 in the A201, and owner's right to carry out the work. Owner always has the right to stop the work as well. So it's a matter of making sure that the owner's aware of all their responsibilities and things that they're aware to do. But, of course, again, in law, you know, the owner has to write a letter and submit it to the general contractor, giving the GC 10 days to correct the work. If not, then they will, the owner will go in, hire subs, and correct the work, and then probably backcharge the contractor 3 times the amount. But anyway, so A201, take a look at that, and submittal samples and shop drawings. The architect's responsibility, of course, is just to review them on the basis of design intent only. And the contractor's job, of course, is to review them based on accuracy, fabrication, and quantity. And so they don't come right out and ask you a question in this exam. They kind of round about it. You know, the architect and owner just received a claim from the contractor to remake an item because of dimensional error on that shop drawing. What should the architect do? You know, something like that. What they're really asking, if you take a layer off of that question, is do you realize the responsibilities of each party in reviewing submittal samples and shop drawings? That's what they're really asking. I think every question in this exam can be broken apart, and you know, you can kind of listen to what is really being asked. That's kind of the way that we need to answer. They have substantial completion, of course, the definition there as well. So just be aware that project closeout, which commences with the request of the general contractor to the architect and owner to come out and verify. See, as architects, we verify first, and then we certify. Certify basically means that I'm signing to the effect that I verified. That's all certification is. and I'm not approving anything as an architect. I don't inspect at the job site. I observe. You have to watch out with the terms that you're using with respect to the people you're talking about in this exam as well. Okay, architects are not owners' representatives, even though some parts of AIA says that we are, and the CAB knows that there is some incorrect semantics in AIA contracts, so they're going to kind of test you on that knowledge. The owner, if they cannot make all the meetings and so on the project, then they need to hire a legal representative and not send you, the architect, to meetings for them and then fill them in later. If you're in reporter mode, you're in a wrong position. So it's a matter of communicating to the client that the client needs to hire a representative. I use the word client and owner synonymous in my lectures here. So if they cannot make all the meetings, then the owner needs to hire a legal rep and not a CM or a GC. It has to be a third party separate that the architect can take direction from and keep moving forward on this project. Okay. So this is what needs to really be discussed in your first meeting with the client, you know. About 3 days prior to our first meeting with the client, I asked the client to bring with them in writing their budget, schedule, program criteria, I call it wish list, construction management requirements if they have any, level of quality, okay? And also in that meeting, I mentioned, the architect mentions to the owner that we don't recommend contractors anymore. We will be looking for that list from the owner about halfway in the construction documents, so we can send out the A305s, contractor's qualification statements, if we're going to formal bid it, if it's a private formal bid, you know, and go from there. So you give the client a heads up way in advance, okay, and so you just have to, they do talk about Article 12.3, acceptance of nonconforming work. Here it's just talking about the owner can accept aesthetic issues and change those, but not code. See, when a client or an owner reads that particular statement, they're thinking they can change code, and they can't. So just make sure that you're keeping them aware of what's going on. You will find that in architecture, advising and informing the owner are your number one, you know, reflection of properly doing architecture, okay? And it's a matter of and going through and making sure that you're advising and informing the client. You see, as an architect, we have no power. We advise, inform, educate, recommend, present ideas. We don't decide anything regarding client or agency issues. Those are the two entities we take direction from. And so it's a matter of the client understanding that, and again in the first meeting, is that I cannot make your decisions for you. My job as an architect is to get you the information you need so you can make proper decisions. Okay, the decisions need to come from you, the owner, as long as they're in conformance to your criteria and also agency criteria. Okay, I just can't present anything non-conforming to code. I mean, you know, it has to conform to code and client, and that's the challenge of the architect. When we generate documents and design issues and such, it has to be complying with all criteria, which is owner and agency criteria. Okay. So the owner needs to understand all that as well. They need to be at all meetings and make the decisions progressively, as expeditiously as possible, you know, as it goes through and talks about that. And so you can kind of look through the AIA contracts. They might test you on that. And then we go into the Title 24 issues and administrative code, how the codes are come about and who enforces them, and then they have the interpretive manual, of course, that the inspectors walk around with as well, and then volumes 1 and 2 that we look at as architects and our consultants look at, our engineers look at volume 2, and then, of course, we have electrical code and mechanical code. They will test your knowledge on certain disciplines in this exam as well, okay? For example, HVAC, they usually like to always ask you this: halfway into construction documents or construction phase, the client, your client, also owns the property next door, wants you to look into the possibility of tapping into their existing central plant for this new project, which is adjacent to theirs, or a standalone HVAC system. Discuss both, compare, contrast, Okay, and so on. And so the architect that, I mean, the candidate in this exam has to have some knowledge of HVAC. You know, but again, I suggest to keep it down to the one-minute rule. You know, keep it very compressed, generalized. I mean, the job of the panel is to come back and ask you for more specifics if that was not specific enough. I would not offer that all the specifics first shot. I'd basically say, well, the architect should investigate the existing condition of that central plant, the size and the condition that it's in, and also the distance it is away from this new project we're working on. Is it up to date with regards to energy efficiency and such? Then we can look also at a standalone system, HVAC all-air or hydronics, heat pumps, split system package. Of course, we'll zone the building for efficiency. The architect would have a meeting with their HVAC engineer, maybe preliminarily if it's in the design stages, and then set up a meeting with the client and present both situations to the client, let the client decide which system they want to go with and move forward. As long as it complies, again, with their criteria and code issues, then we're fine. Okay, so it must be feasible, of course. I mean, they might ask us for a recommendation, the owner, and we'll give them one, and we'll give them a reason for that recommendation, of course. You know, you should never do a recommendation unless you have basis to, or you should, you know, you should never do a recommendation unless you have something to base it on, I should say. And so create your basis first, then your recommendation, you know. And so, but that's just a recommendation. It's not a decision, and the owner needs to realize that. Title 24, Part 6, Energy Issues, for example, and, of course, that's written by the California Energy Commission. They have a department up in Sacramento based on the 16 climate zones of California. And we're looking at the two standard methods of prescriptive or performance methods as well. And prescriptive, of course, is established data for one of the 16 climate zones in the state. And performance is a computer analysis approved by the California Energy Commission. And we use that. And we're allowed to interchange within the elements on a performance method. Okay, so we can do R11 in exterior walls, but we might have to end up doing R100 in the roof just to make up for it, you see. Whereas in prescriptive method, it was established data, and we had to stay with that data and plug it into our building, and the building complied. So there's not really calculations in the prescriptive method. There are calculations in the performance method. So the performance method, of course, is the more energy efficient of the two, and this is enforced by the local agencies. It's written by California Energy Commission, CEC, but it's enforced by the local agencies, building and safety and such. Okay. We also have the historical building code. The purpose of this is to preserve the historical essence of the building and still keep it safe for the occupants. And so we go through, and if we can get it approved by the State Historical Society with a plaque we put at the front door and a number, then we can apply the historical building code, which means leniency. That's the advantage of this particular code being applied. Okay? And then, of course, there's also the categories of the exam as well. And I think these categories came in your test brochure, or you can print these out as well. But we have four standard categories: context and pre-design. It's almost the way a project progresses. Context, pre-design, then we do code checks, otherwise known as regulatory issues, and then we put a team together in the office, and then we're under construction phase. Okay, so those are like the four categories of the exam: context and pre-design, regulatory, management and design, and construction. Okay. So in context and pre-design, of course, in this particular category, they are testing us on our knowledge of preliminary knowledge on a project if we're hired for these phases, probably pre-design, site analysis, phase one, phase two. Okay. And the things that we need to look for, you know, contextuality, how this building is going to fit into context with the community, architectural style, massing, color, textures, all of that. And then we go into collecting data, okay, synthesizing it, applying what's applicable and throwing out what's not, and then putting a proper program criteria together at the end of this phase, okay, what we feel would best fit on this site and most feasible and all that type of thing as well. So we go through and take a look at that, and then we have regulatory issues, which is in California and then outside California. So category, subcategory A, California laws, codes, regulations, and standards. And, you know, keeping in mind that the architect's responsibility is to generate documents according to those laws, codes, regulations, and standards and understand all what's applicable. And it's not the general contractor's job. I see that sometimes on general notes. The general contractor shall confirm that all these documents are in conformance too. It's like, no, you can throw that statement as far as you can. Any judge knows that in court. So architects generate the documents according to all criteria, meaning agency and client, the two entities we take direction from, right? And it's up to the contractor. I mean, it's the responsibility of the contractor to build according to those documents. All right. And we go from there. So that's regulatory issues outside California, state, federal, and then there's inside the state as well. Management decisions and putting a team together inside the office, knowing the strengths and weaknesses of your team is very important as well. Okay, and so we go through and we take a look at putting a team together, as well as our consultants outside the office. Okay, so are they the appropriate consultants for this project? How many retail shopping centers have they done before? Okay, that type of thing. So we don't want to pay to train. We need to make sure that they've had that experience on that type of project before. And then we have the construction phase, 15% of your grade, and here it goes into talking about responsibilities of all parties during this phase. And again, your A201 might come into play here as well. But, I mean, that's the purpose of the general condition of the contract, is to describe all the parties involved with the project during construction. There are specific responsibilities and procedures to follow as well. Okay, so it's a matter of taking a look at the A201. Keep in mind that construction managers are also consultants of the owner, but we do not take direction from them as architects. I mean, I keep it simple. Who signed your contract? That's who you take direction from. So everybody else is a consultant of the owner, unless it's their legal rep. That's the only two individuals I take direction from is the owner or their legal rep. Okay. A legal rep can be a letter from the owner or a power of attorney form sent to the architect, say, take direction from this individual in my absence, and fine, we're ready to go with that. Okay, so especially if the owner's, you know, flying all over the world or, coordinating 30 other projects or whatever. So you have to kind of, you know, be aware of that, okay, as well. So construction phase, all the responsibilities the architect is responsible for in this phase. Okay, construction phase. So they will go through and talk to you about that. All right. Just a couple of things. Also, this session is only an hour long, so I've got to pack 3 hours into 1 hour here. But just keep in mind, in this exam, half of this exam, I'm convinced, is physical. It's presentation technique. Okay. And so it's a matter of presenting yourself in front of the panel. Okay, when your exam is, of course, when it goes into written form, then you're going to have other challenges. You know, if you take that exam, then physical presentation. But this exam at this time is a physical presentation exam, so you do have to present yourself professionally. Think and be well dressed, well groomed, sit erect, undivided attention. You've got to give your responses only to the one panel person that asked the question. It's not important that you have to broadcast your answer to the other two at that time. Okay. So there's some body language that comes into play here. You will have the 20-minute review that you go into and review the documents. And just keep in mind that the 20-minute review, you should be not only familiarizing yourself with the documents, but anticipating questions about them. Okay, it's a different frame of mind then. Okay, so, seismic, accessibility, energy, okay, understanding all of the jurisdictional agencies that affect this project and how, you know, those types of questions, okay? So you have to get yourself focused on that. You'll be looking at a project description sheet, 8.5 by 11, just a description of the project and the client, the location, where it is, and so on. Read that first. And then you'll be given 3 drawings, site plan, with probably floor plan or floor plan superimposed on top of it. And then you'll have exterior elevations, a second sheet, and then the third sheet would be a cross-section, maybe a roof plan, a detail. Okay, so here are your documents, and you got 20 minutes to review them, okay? And then, now these documents are the same documents that are in front of you during the exam, on the table facing you, okay? So you'll have your project description sheet, your 3 drawings, and then also they are giving us the written question to us as well that we can see. Okay, and only one at a time. But the question, even though it's 8 and 9 parts in front of us, we might ask the panel to go ahead and repeat that while I look at the drawings, you see. I mean, give them a purpose to be there. So you can ask them to do that. That's what they're there for, as well as grading you. They won't come up with your final grade. They are grading you. Sacramento will come up with your final grade. That's why it takes 3 to 4 weeks to get your results usually. And then you'll get your results, and hopefully you don't have to come back into this exam again. So, okay, so I kind of ran through most of the material, but these are the things that we cover in our seminars, our teleseminars, which are live and recorded. You can look at those if you can't make any of the seminars. Also, our workshops, which I'm very proud of. We do those on Wednesday afternoons in Southern California because we have a conference space here. And we do the seminars here. We meet 4 Wednesdays and from 1 to 5 in the afternoon. And the people that attend those usually end up with about a 90% passing rate, we've found. I mean, I've been doing this for over 28 years, okay? Most of the other individuals or organizations just came on board shortly. So that's why we can pretty much guarantee your with a high passing rate, okay, as you attend. So we've got seminars. We do the 3 seminars just before the exam. That's on the Friday, Saturday. We call it Friday, Saturday series. On Friday evening from 6:30 to 9:30, we do the category lecture, those 55 categories that I just ran through quickly. And then Saturday morning, 9 to 12, we do the overview seminar, going through the list of 11 items that I mentioned earlier here in this session. We do those pretty intensively. And then that afternoon, the Saturday afternoon from 1 to 5, we do the mock sessions where we simulate a real panel. You come up and answer questions, and then critiquing is offered. So you're going through the exercise, actually. And you get to come with me on the other side of the table and ask questions and critique candidates in front of you as well. So there's a lot of role-playing going on, okay? And so that's the mock sessions that occur on that Saturday afternoon. So we do that on the Friday and Saturday, the weekend before the exam. You can always look at our website, which is mba-architectural.com, and you can take a look at that. I think we're number 1 on Yahoo and Google as well. MBA Architectural is what it's called. And then we also take those 3 seminars and put them on a Saturday, usually about a month before the exam. We call it the 3-in-1. 3 seminars in 1 day. Okay, that's why it's called 3-in-1. And you can always look at our website for that as well. So it's a pretty intensive day. It's taking those 3 seminars, putting it into 1 day. Okay, so we always usually do it around 30 days prior to the exam. So you can take a look at that one as well. Of course, I do phone tutoring and Skyping, you know, as well if you like. So there's a lot of information that my company offers to try to get you through these exams, okay, this California oral exam. But the intention here for you is to get through them, pass the first time or the next time. As you might know, the passing rate is ranging in the range of about 50%. So in other words, half the people taking this exam do not pass, okay? And I think one of the reasons for that is they think they can kind of walk in there with their experience, you know, and then they come out with their head spinning, all right? So there's a technique in going into this exam, you know, and again, it has nothing to do with your personal experience, okay? So leave that out the door, so to speak, when you go into this exam, all right? I mean, the rest of that visual trip and reviewing that 20-minute review would be to, after 20 minutes, the proctor will say, okay, we're done, and then they're going to usher you up into another area, okay? What they do is they buy, I think, the top 2 floors of the Embassy Suites. That's where your exam is, by the way, is one of the rooms of the suite of the Embassy Suite Hotel. And then they're going to usher you into another room where it's just chairs, and all you do is just sit there and you wait for your name to be called, okay? And sometimes candidates choose to do either meditation or they go back into their mind, close their eyes, and think about the documents they just looked at, and can they keep thinking about those and come up with some more questions, anticipating more questions and such. And when I took my orals, I think I went through right around 400 possible questions. You know, I wasn't going to be throwing a curve, and so of different types of projects, okay, as well. And then, of course, I took my projects in at that time, and those were Days of the Cakewalk. So that was back in the early 90s, no, late 80s. And so, anyway, the exam has changed every 3 years. It's changing again January 2011. It just changed in 2009, January. It was updating the new codes, 2007 CBC, and the 07 AIE contracts that were updated and such. So it goes through and kind of, you know, every 2-3 years it changes in some new format. So let's get it this year, and then you don't have to worry about the new format coming online January 2011. But if you have any questions, give me a call. Again, the number here is 949 area code. It's 208-2979. And I'm here to help you and get you through this exam. Well, thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll talk soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.